The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter, and the first article is coming from an interview with Dr. Eugene Braunwald, who is a very famous Harvard cardiologist, who is sometimes called the father of modern cardiology. In this interview, he shares his perspective on promising future directions in the field of cardiology. Long-term readers of the Heart Letter know that most of our stories focus on steps you can take right now to improve your heart health. But once in a while, we look ahead at what's on the horizon in the dynamic field. We consulted Dr. Eugene Braunwald, distinguished Hershey Professor of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School, where he has worked since 1972. At age 94, he continues to work and publish, adding to the more than 1,100 articles he has authored since the early 1950s. His pioneering research helped elucidate how heart attacks happen, which ushered in new ways to treat and prevent them. Dr. Braunwald's discoveries also advanced the understanding of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, valvular heart disease, and heart failure. His life and research are described in Eugene Braunwald and the Rise of Modern Medicine, written by former Harvard Heart Letter Editor-in-Chief Dr. Thomas Lee. The trends Dr. Braunwald is most excited about, summarized below, may one day affect heart health at every stage of life, from birth to old age. Number one, primordial prevention. Dr. Braunwald: the future of cardiology will focus on preventing heart disease very early in life, a concept known as primordial prevention. Instead of waiting until people develop risk factors like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or diabetes and treating them, we'll be able to identify and prevent the development of those conditions in the first place. Many of these conditions are caused not by a single gene, but by many genes. We now have specialized genetic tests to create polygenic risk scores that help predict cardiovascular risks. See Genetic Profiling for Heart Disease, an update in the October 2023 Heart Letter. In the future, these tests will become more accurate and less expensive, so I foresee doing these tests in newborns. For example, if a baby has genes linked to the development of high blood pressure by age 30, you could modify that child's diet to prevent the problem. Focusing on prevention very early in life could make a huge difference in reducing cardiovascular disease, which remains the most common cause of death in adults worldwide. Number two, targeting inflammation. For people who already have heart disease, medications that lower blood pressure and cholesterol are important parts of avoiding future heart problems. Until recently, however, there haven't been any drugs to address inflammation, which ignites the artery-damaging process that leads to a heart attack. But in June 2023, the FDA approved the anti-inflammatory drug colchicine for people who have or are at high risk for heart disease. The drug, which has been used for many years to treat gout, can lower the risk of heart attack and related problems by about 30%. Investigators in the pharmaceutical industry are now looking very closely at this category of medications. Going forward, I predict there will be a whole battery of new anti-inflammatory drugs. It'll be similar to the current situation with high blood pressure, where we have many different drugs that doctors can use to treat this common problem. Number three, cardiac cell therapy. A heart attack cuts off blood flow to part of the heart's muscle, creating damage that scars the heart. Over time, especially in people with repeat heart attacks, this can impair the heart's ability to function normally, leading to heart failure. For more than two decades, scientists have tried to repair damaged hearts using cardiac cell therapy, also called stem cell therapy. The original concept was to infuse large numbers of stem cells derived from bone marrow into the heart to regenerate heart muscle cells. The initial results appeared promising, but these cells aren't incorporated into the heart muscle and they quickly disappear. Now several other techniques are being explored, including isolating the substances released from transplanted cells that appear to be responsible for these benefits. By making these substances, which include factors that encourage blood vessel growth, in the lab, we might be able to provide cell therapy without cells. Dr. Braunwald is also excited about the promise of pluripotent stem cells, a discovery based on technology that was awarded the 2012 Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology. These are cells that have been reprogrammed into their embryonic state and can therefore be directed to generate any type of adult cells, including heart muscle cells. Number four, transplanting pig hearts. Despite steady progress in heart transplantation, many hundreds of people die every year waiting for a heart transplant. Over the years, there have been a number of successful interspecies transplants known as xenotransplantation, that's X-E-N-O, including in non-human primates. In the last 2 years, two men with end-stage heart failure received transplants using genetically modified pig hearts. One survived for 6 weeks, the other for 2 months. Pigs are a logical choice because their hearts are similar in size to humans. In both cases, several genes in the donor pig were inactivated, and human genes were inserted into the pig's genome to stop the recipient from rejecting the new organ. These early studies have paved the way for further advances in xenotransplantation. Finally, improved left ventricular assist devices. A left ventricular assist device, or LVAD, is a small pump implanted in the chest to help a greatly weakened, failing heart deliver blood to the body. In addition to becoming smaller, more powerful, and less expensive, LVADs will undergo other improvements in the coming years. Current devices use a drive line, a cable that passes through the skin, to connect the pump to a battery and control system worn outside the body. In the future, devices will be charged through the skin without requiring a drive line, which is a common place for infections. Another potential advance is the use of biocompatible materials in the pump, which means patients might not need to take anti-clotting drugs. People with advanced heart failure may receive an LVAD, which remember is a left ventricular assist device, temporarily while waiting for a heart transplant, or even instead of a transplant, in what we call destination therapy. Now, once again in the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2024, we're going to turn to a question and answer session with Dr. Christopher Cannon, who is the editor-in-chief. Question. Your Q&A about elevated troponin levels in the October 2023 issue reminded me about a related issue I've been wondering about. I'm a 76-year-old woman with heart disease, which has necessitated several visits to the emergency room in recent years. I've heard that biotin supplements, which are supposed to promote hair and nail growth, can affect the accuracy of a troponin test. If this is a valid concern, is there a threshold for the amount of biotin a person can take? It's found in nearly all multiple vitamins. And Dr. Cannon responds, Yes, taking supplements that contain high levels of biotin, vitamin B7, can lead to falsely low or falsely high results on a troponin test. Troponin, a protein found in heart muscle, is released into the bloodstream during a heart attack. Measuring blood troponin levels is a standard way to diagnose a heart attack. The biotin issue is a valid concern. Inaccurate results on a troponin test can lead to a mixed diagnosis with potentially serious consequences, according to a 2017 warning letter from the FDA. In at least one case, a person who was taking high doses of biotin died after a falsely low troponin test result. The problem occurs because laboratory tests use technology that incorporates biotin because it binds to specific proteins, including troponins. Excessive biotin in the blood can interfere with the biotin used in the test. Since the FDA's warning, many but not all troponin test manufacturers have taken steps to address the risk. How much biotin is too much? The recommended dietary allowance for biotin is 0.03 milligrams, which you can easily get just by eating a healthy, varied diet. The best dietary sources of biotin are eggs, fish, nuts, seeds, and vegetables, especially sweet potatoes. Many multivitamins and prenatal vitamins contain far more biotin than the RDA. And some supplements, particularly those marketed to improve hair, nails, and skin, contain 20 milligrams, or nearly 650 times the RDA. A biotin deficiency can cause hair loss and brittle nails, but that doesn't mean healthy people will reap any benefit from taking biotin supplements. According to the NIH Office of Dietary Supplements, the claims supporting better hair and nail health from biotin supplements are based on a few case reports and small studies. Doctors sometimes suggest taking a multiple vitamin if there's concern that you aren't getting sufficient amounts of one or more vitamins or minerals. If you do take a multiple vitamin, avoid brands that contain more than the recommended daily allowance for biotin. The next article is called Why You Should Walk with a Doc. That's D-O-C. These free physician-led walks, available in 560 locations throughout the United States, offer benefits beyond boosting physical activity. You know that walking helps your heart, so does spending time with other people, being outside in nature, and learning about ways to improve your health and well-being. Want to get all four at once? Show up at a Walk with a Doc event. Launched in 2005, this nonprofit organization sponsors free, doctor-led walks in mostly outdoor venues across America. Today, Walk with a Doc is in 34 countries worldwide. In surveys and focus groups, participants give the program high marks. Nearly all of the responders, 96%, say they strongly agree that Walk with a Doc has helped them to lead a healthier lifestyle. According to a 2020 article in Current Cardiology Reports, co-authored by Walk with a Doc founder, Dr. David Sabgier. The program's initial inspiration was to encourage people to be less sedentary. But the informal teaching that happens before and during the walks is a boon for patients and doctors alike, says cardiologist Dr. Simon Lee, associate physician at the Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. In our current healthcare system, most of the care is compressed into short office visits. Walk with the Doc gives physicians time to discuss important health topics, like exercise, diet, and stress management in greater depth. Dr. Lee started the Walk with a Doc chapter in Jamaica Plain, the Boston neighborhood bordering the Longwood Medical Area, which is home to Harvard Medical School and many of its affiliated medical institutions. Most of the chapters do monthly walks, but I wanted to encourage continuity and habit formation, so I did my walks every week, says Dr. Lee. The walks, which are currently led by her Brigham and Women's colleague, Dr. Catherine Wang, feature a 1.5-mile loop around Jamaica Pond every Wednesday evening at 5:30. In general, weekday walks are about 30 minutes long. Weekend walks may last 60 to 90 minutes. About 5 minutes before starting the walk, the doctor speaks on various topics of interest, including those requested by the participants. For her initial walks, Dr. Lee focused on the recommended dose of exercise. During the walk, she demonstrated what moderate intensity exercise looks like. I'd tell people to notice how I could still talk in full sentences, but then my breathing was a little heavier than when we were just standing around. During later walks, she taught interval training by cueing the group to pick up their walking pace for a few minutes and then to pull back and return to their normal walking speed. Interval training is a good way to add variety to your workout and is especially helpful for improving cardiovascular fitness, she notes. Sometimes it can feel futile to just rattle off some basic counseling about exercise during an office visit. It's so much more powerful when you can demonstrate in person, she says. As much as we appreciate all the medications we have at our fingertips to manage cardiovascular disease, people really are interested in doing things for their health that doesn't involve taking pills, Dr. Lee says. She also did a series of talks about how exercise benefits so many chronic health conditions, including high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, dementia, and cancer. As Dr. Sabgir wrote in his article, most Americans are living lives that are sedentary, lonely, and not connected with nature. Many walk with the doc programs, including Dr. Lee's, have helped foster social connections and forge friendships among the participants. The walks she led often included 10 or more people, would sometimes bring friends or family members along. Creating a shared sense of community is a really important aspect of the program. So is the stress-relieving power of spending time in nature, which has become less and less common. Research suggests that over half of all Americans spend fewer than 5 hours outdoors each week. In our increasingly digital world, where people spend a lot of time inside in front of screens, it's just lovely to be outside to get fresh air and witness a beautiful sunset in the changing seasons, says Dr. Lee. Now, here's a interesting article, again from the Harvard Heart Letter, and it's entitled, Should You Worry About Your Waistline? Having a large belly is dangerous to heart health. Learn if you're at risk and what to do about it. Extra padding around your midsection goes by many different names. A spare tire, muffin top, or love handles. Too much of any type of fat isn't healthy, but some forms are worse than others. The flab you can pinch between your fingers is called subcutaneous fat, which lies just underneath the skin. A more worrisome type of fat lies deep within the abdominal cavity, padding the space between your organs. Known as visceral fat, it does more than add inches around your waistline. It also raises your risk of cardiovascular problems. Growing evidence suggests that your waist circumference is a better predictor of heart disease than your body mass index, says Dr. Osama Hamdi, medical director of the obesity clinic program at Harvard-affiliated Joslin Diabetes Center. Body mass index, an indirect estimate of body fat based on height and weight, doesn't distinguish between the different types of fat. People can have what's considered a healthy BMI, but still have a large belly and visceral fat, says Dr. Hamdi. Another measurement, the waist-to-hip ratio, correlates with visceral fat, but there's no need to do that extra hip measurement or math because waist circumference alone is strongly linked to visceral fat. Why is visceral fat dangerous? Visceral fat is also a marker for ectopic fat, which is fat that accumulates inside organs like the liver, the heart, and the pancreas, and the muscles. Both types of fat are closely tied to metabolic problems, especially type 2 diabetes, which in turn is a potent risk factor for heart disease. In addition, visceral fat secretes hormones and other inflammatory factors, collectively called adipokines or cytokines, which trigger a buildup of fatty plaque inside arteries. Your genes, ethnic background, and sex all influence how likely you are to accumulate visceral fat. Native Americans, notably the Pima tribe, Hispanics, and people living in India or South Asia, have a higher likelihood of abdominal obesity. In addition, white men and black women tend to accumulate relatively more visceral fat compared with black men and white women. Some people are predisposed to a larger midsection. There's a lot you can do to remedy the problem, says Dr. Hamdi. Get regular exercise. Sit-ups or other abdominal exercises won't shrink your belly. Instead, you need to burn calories to lose fat and build muscle. Aim for 30 minutes daily of moderate intensity exercise and do strength-based exercise 2 days per week. Follow a healthy, reduced carbohydrate diet. Avoid foods and drinks with added sugars and other simple carbohydrates that spike blood sugar and encourage your body to store fat. These include foods made with white flour, like pasta, pizza, pretzels, bread, and bagels, and starchy foods like white potatoes, white rice, and corn. Try time-restricted eating. Some research suggests this strategy may lower blood sugar level and reduce visceral fat. There are many ways to structure your eating. For example, you might eat only between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. and fast during the other 16 hours. This not only limits calorie intake, but also kickstarts the body's fat-burning process. Now I'm going to turn to a section entitled Research We're Watching in the Harvard Heart Letter of January 2024. And the first one is, marijuana use disorder may raise the risk of heart problems. Up to 3 in 10 people who use marijuana may be unable to stop using the drug, even when it has harmful effects on their lives. A new study suggests that this problem, known as cannabis use disorder, or CUD, is linked to a substantially higher risk of cardiovascular problems. The study included nearly 60,000 people registered in Canadian health databases. About half of them had CUD. Researchers found that compared to people without CUD, those with CUD were about 60% more likely to experience a heart attack, stroke, or other cardiovascular problem. Published online September 27, 2023 in the journal Addiction, the results do not provide evidence of cause and effect, but earlier research has implicated marijuana use in raising blood pressure and causing a range of heart-related problems. Another brief article, coated aspirin and regular aspirin, similar benefits and risks. Most of the aspirin sold in the United States is what's called enteric-coated or safety-coated aspirin. It has a smooth coating that protects it from stomach acid, allowing the drug to be released in the intestine instead of the stomach. For people taking daily aspirin to help their hearts, doctors often recommend coated aspirin based on an unproven belief that's less likely to cause gastrointestinal bleeding. But doing so raises a different concern. Does the coating make aspirin less effective for preventing heart attacks? A study published November 1, 2023 in JAMA Cardiology looked at both issues. Researchers analyzed more than 2 years' worth of data from 10,700 people taking aspirin for cardiac disease. Most took coated aspirin daily, while the rest took uncoated aspirin. Both forms of aspirin proved equally effective for preventing death or hospitalization from a heart attack or stroke. However, when it came to avoiding major bleeding episodes, the coated aspirin offered no advantage over the uncoated pills. Aspirin is usually recommended for heart attack survivors. But for everyone else, the decision depends on their age, sex, and risk of heart attack and bleeding. Finally, briefly, poor sleep is linked to high blood pressure. Sleep problems, including trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, and too little sleep, are associated with greater risk of high blood pressure in women, according to a new study. Published in the November 2023 issue of Hypertension, the study tracked the health of 66,000 women for 16 years. When the study began in 2001, the women did not have hypertension. After researchers accounted for various demographic and lifestyle factors, they found that compared to women who slept 7 to 8 hours daily, those who slept 5 or 6 hours were 10% and 7% respectively more likely to develop hypertension. Women who said they sometimes or usually had trouble falling asleep were also more likely to have hypertension compared to those who rarely had trouble sleeping. This doesn't prove that sleep problems cause elevated blood pressure, but one possible explanation for the link may be increased stress, which is associated with both poor sleep and high blood pressure. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.